It is 25 and a half after the hour. It's Tuesday, and that's the day we welcome Dr. Don Clark to the, well, you're not really in the studio. Don's up in Garden Valley, Texas. I say up. If David were saying this, he would say down, in because north is up and south is down. Is that right? I think that's right. And so Don's in Garden Valley, Texas. He's just about 200 miles to our northeast from our location in Central Texas. He's a biochemist, a member of the board at Creation Moments, and a vintner. Runs a winery in Garden Valley. Beautiful place. Valle della Pace is the name. You can look him up. Great website, too. And you can even link to it from our site here on BrokenRoadRadio.com. Don, we've got... It's kind of an old argument here, but I want to pose the headline of this article to you and ask a question. Humans and Neanderthals are more similar than polar and brown bears. Now, the part that strikes me is that it says humans and Neanderthals as if they were two different critters.
Well, evolutionary thinking is that they were two different creatures, that they were some type of pre-human, if you will, or an ancestor that was so far, from us that they couldn't possibly have been human. But a new study actually shows that they had the capability, if they were alive today, to mate with humans of today. More so, and that was the point of the title. I mean, the title's a little confusing because the point of the title was they were closer in DNA, if you will, fingerprinting than polar and brown bears are to each other. Now, we know that I don't know if we know, but, scientists know that polar and brown bears can mate with each other. And so the study was one of a genetic study, and I think they were looking at the mitochondrial DNA in the different species. And they did a study that said, okay, we know these animals mate together, these species mate together. And what we want to do is find out how different does the DNA have to be before the animals no longer mate with each other. And so they did that study, and then they came back and looked at DNA from the Neanderthals and in modern humans, and found out, lo and behold, that, not only is the DNA so close, there's a great, very high probability that they would be able to mate with each other without any problem because the DNA was so close. It was closer, as a matter of fact, than the polar bears and the brown bears. But as we said earlier, we know that those already mate with each other. So, hence the title of the study, and they actually, looked at the mitochondrial DNA, did a lot of different species in a lot of different animals to get the variants, it's called genetic distancing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so they looked at the genetic distancing between the humans, the Neanderthals, and the Denisovans, which is another thought to be pre-old human type of human.
It's tempting to call them a different race, but it turns out that it seems to me, and we've talked about this before, that the differences in DNA between species of mammals in particular is so slight. It's like 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 10% difference. I'm not sure exactly how they measure that, but at what point do you define a Neanderthal or a Denisovan as a separate race? Because we've talked about Genesis as defining, didn't use the word race or species. It says kind. How would we put that in scientific terms? Kind is that's more general than a species, right?
Yeah, it's more like a family. So in the classification, in the biological classification, a kind is more like a family. And one of the primary tests for a kind is does the species, does the different species, for example, mate with each other?
And this article goes a step further. The offspring has to also be fertile. Because I'm thinking, what was it, mules who are infertile, a product between a donkey and a horse or something close to that? I may have mixed up a little bit. But they turn out to be infertile, don't they?
Yes, they do. So, yes, it has to be fertile, but not necessarily to also be in the same kind. I'll give you an example. But the northern jackrabbit cannot mate, or I mean, if it does mate, it doesn't produce offspring with the southern jackrabbit. But there's an intermediate jackrabbit in between the northern and the southern, with that both of them can mate with, but yet they you know, and they produce offspring. So the DNA diverged enough between the northern and the southern that they can no longer produce offspring directly. So there's an indirect link between the intermediate jackrabbit and but we would still call them of the same kind, for example. This article also mentioned, I think, the wolf and
coyotes, I think they're talking about.
Anyway, if, you know, they can mate. We've known that they can mate, so they are of the same kind. And of course, you know, wolves and dogs, and you know, the dog species, and they're all of the same kind, even though they behave differently and they have a little bit different look. Now, with the Neanderthal, the problem with the Neanderthal and why they were classified as less than human was because they had the furrowed brow, and you know, the pronounced brow and the sloped forehead. So they thought, oh well, you know, looks more like a monkey than a human. And so they said, yeah, okay, they're a little bit earlier in our development than the modern human.
See, and that has to assume that we developed from an ape-like creature. I mean, that assumption is explicit in that finding.
Absolutely. And so you know, if your assumptions are wrong, then your conclusions are going to be wrong as well. And as it turns out, gee, we have people living today with the same type of brow ridge and sloped forehead, but they're obviously very much human. And even though some people would like to call them subhuman, they are not. They're fully human with all the human traits that you and I and everybody else has. So just because you have a browed ridge or a sloping forehead doesn't necessarily mean that you are subhuman. And indeed, from a Genesis and from a creation point of view, one asked the question, and we tackled this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the migration of people groups from the Tower of Babel and where they wound up going. And of course they migrated according to their new language that they acquired after the confusion of the languages at Babel. And some of them migrated north, and the northern migration then, some of them would have been these Neanderthal. So they are descendants of Noah, like we are descendants of Noah. And they just happened to wind up in that location. And in a matter of fact, you know, as you get older, your brow ridge gets more pronounced. And you may or may not have a sloping forehead, but at least your brow ridge gets more pronounced because your bones continue to grow. You don't necessarily continue to grow upward, but as we know, as we get older, we continue to grow wider, if you will. So the continual growth of the facial bones then makes us look more like ape-like, if you will, than you know, a nice young fresh human would look. So we should take the brow ridge then as a more aged individual necessarily than not, you know, perhaps. And so perhaps the Neanderthals were, you know, we know for a fact, because the Bible records it, that the folks lived longer immediately after the flood than we live today. And so by living longer, then you would see some features that we don't necessarily see a lot of today because we don't live as long. And so the Neanderthals could have been maybe couple of hundred years, their lifespan could have been a couple of hundred years or so, maybe 300 years, excuse me, old, and so they were, you know, from being a more direct descendant, if you will, from the Noah.
So what you're saying, correct me if I'm not hearing you right here, but you're saying the findings of Neanderthal remains, burial pits or caves or wherever they're coming up with these bones and these skeletons and saying, aha, there was a sloping forehead and a pronounced brow ridge, suggest they found the bones, the remains of old people.
Yes, perhaps. Yes, indeed. And
assume that was typical of the people group.
Right. And because they lived in cage, so you had these features that suggested to the evolutionists that, oh, these are primitive, you know, primitive humans. And we, when you go into museums and stuff, and you see these, see the Neanderthals depicted in a diorama, for example, they are wearing animal skins and they're crouching down in a more animal-like posture instead of just, you know, upright like a human would be today. They automatically pull you in to this story that they're not quite human yet. You know, they're getting there because they're using tools and they're crouching over a fire and they might be cooking something. But you know, the depiction's completely wrong. I mean, really, it's these are not only, you know, fully human, as DNA testing has now shown us multiple times, but they were more than likely much, much smarter than we are today. And they had to survive in a very harsh climate. Now, if you're going north, if you're migrating, let's say, from the Shinar, the plain of Shinar and from Babel, you're going north, more hostile environment, especially post-flood, because, you know, post-flood, you've got the Ice Age. And so if you're going north, you're heading towards the more hostile and colder environment. And so you're going to seek out locations that are going to protect you from these snowstorms that you're probably running into and the colder environment that, you know, that certainly would have been there just shortly after the flood.
Well, speaking of the migrations, and we might go back mentally, at least, to one of our earlier programs from the last several weeks, talking about the spread of humanity from the Tower of Babel. There are genealogies in Genesis that indicate offspring of the what's the word I want? Not the forefathers, the what's the word you use for that?
Ancestor.
Ancestor. But yeah, the primary figures in the line, the male figures, and it turns out that in Genesis, their names ultimately become place names, so that you can read in Genesis where these people went to a certain degree, although you have to look up the ancient names of the places. But the places took on the names of the people. So as we mentioned in the podcast, that's how here got its name, from the people, or patriarch. There, thank you. Yes, that's what I'm looking for. that the places where they migrated took on their names of the original inhabitants, and that's one way to trace where these people groups moved. Now, I have another question for you. This article suggests that the DNA was so close that they were all humans, Neanderthals and humans. It's one and the same. How different does DNA have to be before something is non-human? You know, is it a percentage? How do you measure the difference and decide that something that may have had two arms and two legs and walked upright is not human? You know, what point do you make that decision looking at the DNA?
Well, apparently the study actually was looking at the mitochondrial DNA the percentage differences between various species in the mitochondrial DNA. Now, I didn't look at that study, but it probably is reported in reference one, which is the mitochondrial genetic divergence proxy predicts the reproductive capabilities of mammalian hybrids. So that's in the proceedings of the Royal Society. I bet in that report or in that article would be the answer to your question, because they did look at various species, not only that reproduce, that can reproduce, but those that can't reproduce.
Well, let me pose the question a different way. So a spaceship lands and an alien comes out and looks a lot like humans, but he has no discernible connection with humans on Earth. He came from another planet in a far-off solar system. Would his DNA reflect that, or would it be so similar to human we couldn't tell the difference? I mean, that's a very hypothetical sort of situation. But the point is DNA of real value in determining whether or not a creature is human?
Well, it is of value, because if the DNA diverges, far enough, then, like I said, you're not going to... The offspring won't be either fertile, or they won't be able to have offspring.
That might be the real test then. Not so much a divergence in the DNA, because, you know, how diverse does that have to be before it becomes non-human? What I'm doing is calling into question the whole classification system here as being of marginal value when you're getting down to such fine details, fine controls as individual segments of DNA.
Well, there is another problem with all of that, in that we are all designed similarly, right?
Yes.
I mean, there are some proteins, for example, that are so essential that they don't change between a pig and a human, or between a monkey and a human, or between, you know, a rat and a human, simply because we all need that particular protein or enzyme in order to function properly. And then there are others that, you know, are quite diverse. And so when you start doing these DNA studies, I think this is why they went from studying the entire genome of a particular species, one, because it's very, very complex and you need a lot of information in order to be able to do that, but two, there is so much divergence that can happen relatively quickly after an organism, you know, starts reproducing. Imagine, if you will, you have two people, Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve's DNA are very, very compatible with each other, right? Well, Eve was taken out of Adam, so her DNA has to be almost exactly like Adam's, with the difference being the Y chromosome that Adam has and the two X chromosomes that Eve has. Other than that, their DNA should be perfect matches, because Eve, we know, was taken out of Adam. And then as they have offspring, God has allowed for variation within a kind, if you will. So the more times we breed, I mean, I hate to use these words, but I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about. The greater the number of generations past the original perfect copies of the DNA, if you will, the more variations you're going to have, because the DNA can, can bind together slightly differently, and their mutations do show up, which are either neutral or detrimental to the organism.
Those can be measured. Those mutations can be measured, can they not? That's again a percentage.
And they are measured, and we know that the humankind or animal kind isn't that old, based on the rate of mutation. For example, I mean, the more generations that you have, you would expect that the more mutations you're going to have that get passed down to subsequent generations, and in fact, that is the case. And we have now studied enough, and this could be a topic for another, we'd have to look this up, but this could be another topic for another discussion. But the rate then of mutations within a given species, because it's going to be slightly different from species to species, or from kind to kind, if you will, then we could then trace back and say, well, how old is this species, or how old is this kind? And, when you actually do that, you find out that, maybe 6,000 years is what we get, or maybe 4,000, 5,000 years. It always points back to what the Bible says, which is, which is amazing, really. But, it points to the fact that Genesis and the Bible is more historical than a lot of history books, if you will, especially when we're talking about things like this. When we're talking about man's history, because God was so, it was so important for man, it's so important for us, for example, as individuals, and to understand our own identity, to know where we came from. And God was so careful about recording where we came from so that we would know our identity. And in the end, our identity is in God himself, because he is the one who breathed life into us. And this is the message of the Bible. And this is the sad state of affairs when we deviate from the creation story and we come up with other explanations that takes God out of the picture, which the enemy of our soul wants us to do, because then we can say that we want to be our own gods instead of God being God, and that we are made in his image.
Another pertinent idea that I'm moved to point out here is that if we started with perfection, then each subsequent mutation in the DNA is a step further from perfection, which suggests to us, Dr. Don's theory of devolution.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There we go again.
Yeah, always come back to that. Well, I think it's true. We are less than our forebears in many ways. Go ahead, David.
When you publish this, Don, are you going to put our names on the contributor list?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just curious.
You can write the foreword, you know, to the book.
All right. Okay. I get right on that.
Yeah, in our degraded sorts of way. Don, this is fascinating, and I'm looking forward already to next week's topic, which has to do with volcanoes and cataclysmic change. And we'll look forward to the conversation next Tuesday. If anybody wants to see the article we were discussing today, the link is in the chat window at BrokenRoadRadio.com. And also on that page, BrokenRoadRadio.com, you can link to the Creation Moments page, CreationMoments.com. And there you'll discover just a neat website, and it's full of scientific information that supports and tells and retells the biblical story of creation. And I emphasize the word scientific there because it is. And Don, so has our conversation been today. Touched on science and a lot of other things as usual. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Okay, very good. You folks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks much, Don. See you next week.
All right. Come on.